So, I was going to tell the joke about domain-driven design today, but unfortunately you'd have to have the context to get it. Hey, hi, hi, ho, ho, how's it going, guys? Daniel Mark with Nerd Roundup. Where am I? I'm right here. If you've never been to Nerd Roundup, we do this every week. It's articles of the week, programmers talking about articles, team that can have fun and goof off together can do about damn near anything. And so the best way I know to do that is just to get together some friends and talk about what's been going on in the tech world. This week we have, I think, Greg Young just cammed up, and I think James is coming. Greg, how's it going, Greg? Can you hear me? No, you can't hear me. Okay. Greg is our visitor from the silent movie days. Back then, when he started computing, they didn't actually have sound. Sound was invented at some point later. So I am going to carry on, Greg. You get your sound stuff worked out, dude. Okay, what's been going on here? Well, I have been writing this book, Functional Programming Smells. Just got started last couple weeks. I've got the first two chapters out in alpha. I've got some beta alpha readers reading it, and just having a hoot time doing a lot of work with that. That's about it. Since James is not coming up yet, I'm going to go on the articles. Greg, I hope you can get the sound working, dude. How about now? Can you hear me now? No. Okay. So the first article is, will optics ever replace copper interconnects? This is a cool question because we've been talking about this for some time. Why would you have little fiber optics? Everybody wants them because you saw them on Star Wars and Star Trek, but are they actually useful or not? I thought this was a good article to discuss that. So this is from the Register, and the answer is really quite interesting. No, I'm not hearing a dang thing you're saying, Greg. So the answer is quite interesting. We're doing quite a bit, of course, with copper and electrons moving through the wire, and that we've moved that up to the gigahertz range. As we move electrons faster and faster, carrying more and more information, of course, it heats up the wires, so we're kind of reaching a thermal limit with this, the amount we can actually miniaturize electronics. Fiber optics will blow right through that freaking limit. But the problem is that we don't have fiber optic any ideas for how to do that at the micro scale. So really kind of the first step right now is just to develop that on a interconnect basis. And what we're trying to do is develop sort of like a PCI bus or USB 3 or USB 7, I guess, that would use fiber optic. And the idea being that it would be hunka faster than what we got right now. How you doing now, Greg?
I should be good now.
I can hear you. I will be dang.
Okay, I have no idea what actually was going on then, because all I did was reconnect.
Don't ask me these questions. I don't know. So, Greg, did you read the fiber optic article?
I did.
Wasn't that wild?
It's kind of neat. But, so I'm pretty sure with the optical connecting future, and the statement that it's only 10 years away.
Yes.
I read similar articles back when I was in my 20s.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, it's a lot of things, 10 years. Now, the thing is we've been reading for the last year about, like, can you make a laser without integrated circuit? Can you read a laser? So I think they're doing something. I don't think they're nowhere near making a photographic or a photonic processor, maybe a connector. We already have like single fiber connectors. Yeah. How hard could it be? They do this in Star Trek all the time. You pull the cable out, you got these little wires, they got lights on them. It looks easy as heck. What's taking these guys so long anyway? You got the warp drive, you got the jetpacks, you got the optical stuff. I see this stuff on TV all the time. It seems like for some reason they just can't get it done. Okay, so this next article is the been there, done that utility this guy wrote. I saw it on Lobsters last week. I'm like, whoa, that's kind of wild. And that has a fuzzy search. Have you, Greg, have you used your like command line history thing? Why are you talking? Where did he go? See, the thing is, you could just puck me all day long just by moving your mouth as if you were talking. I wouldn't know. if you're broken or not. Maybe it's been working all along. Yeah, I don't know, dude. Well, I tell you what, Greg. I'll ask a question. You move your mouth, and I'll talk at the same time, and maybe nobody will figure out. Hey, Daniel, is that book you're writing awesome or what?
Oh, of course it's awesome.
So, yeah, this is a fuzzy search history. I'm hoping Greg will come back any minute. Looked cool. It looked especially cool because the guy was talking about piping stuff out to this thing. And I was like, whoa, that's some serious Unix kung fu going on there. So this is your old the Bash RC file. That's always fun. So this week we're raising money for a good cause. It's going to be buy Greg a fucking decent set of headphones to wear. That's the new cause we're going to have because he doesn't seem to be able to have one. That's weird. The disconnecting connecting seems to work. That's odd. Next article. This is going to be a freaking quick week. I have a feeling this isn't going to take long at all. Jack Dorsey's TBD represents Bitcoin-based decentralized Web 5. So if you guys have been counting, we're right now at Web 3. I told you like two or three nerd roundups ago, Web 4 was the place to be going. And dang it if Jack Dorsey isn't already moving out to Web 5. So I'm thinking the only thing left here is maybe Web 7 or maybe Web 8 or so. But 3, 4, and 5 look to be currently taken by people building stuff to sell that don't exist yet.
Okay, you should be able to hear me now.
I can hear you now.
Woohoo!
Yes, just whatever you've done, just continue to do that. It's just, you know, last week it was a connection problem. The internet just... And so I stopped and we recorded whatever. And this week it's like, connection is okay, it's fine. But for some reason, sound is an issue.
What I was trying to say on the been there, done that post was that this might be the longest post I've ever seen about 23 lines of code.
It did seem quite, you know, the thing is I was reading it and I was going like, okay, where is the actual article? And I never really got to the damn essay. It wasn't really much there, but I was asking, had you done much with Bash history? Because I keep hearing people talk about, like, all Bash history is awesome. You can do all this stuff with it. And aside from up and down arrow, I don't really use it that much.
You can do a bit with it. So sometimes you'll end up with a reasonably complicated command that you need to run. Mm. And you run relatively often.
Yep.
Let's say one that has 5 or 10 parameters being passed to it. And then it's kind of useful to actually be able to search back through the ones that you've done.
Yeah. Yeah, the
to up arrowing like 27 times.
I've actually done the, but it's here somewhere kind of thing. And that does get kind of tiresome. The thing I've seen I have installed is a Bash history saver. I think it's still on most of my machines where it just sends your history out to like a text file, and so you have like the last 1,000 commands. No matter, you know, if you shut the computer down, come down next week, you still got the last 1,000 commands you've used. So it looks like there's a lot of stuff. This thing this guy built is looks like a parameterized, like they used to call it code snippets. So it's like a, you know, you make an abbreviation for, I don't know, you know, move some files, and then you just go brr, brr, and it takes a couple parameters and kicks out a whole bunch of Bash for you. It's Meta Bash. So, Greg, have you been building anything on Web 5, which has not existed until yesterday?
Sadly, I have not yet, although I'm mostly waiting for the RFC on what Web 5 actually is before I attempt to.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of jobs. You need 10 years experience for most of those. And of course, I have 20 years. I did since it came out yesterday. I was just telling the guys, you know, it's like we were talking Web 3, and I joked, hey, we need to get ahead of the game to Web 4. Web3 is still mostly vaporware. Web4 is just some bullshit I made up. And fuck, Jack Dorsey's already at Web5. Damn it.
I'm wondering when they're going to start not numeraling them anymore. So it's kind of like with Windows. You know, like you had Windows 1, Windows 2, Windows 3, Windows 3.1, yeah. Windows 3.11, yeah. Windows 95.
Yeah, we skipped the 93 versions. Well, see, the thing with putting years on it is then, like, who wants to be using Windows 95? Because it must be really, really old. Of course, what you can do then is just, like, I'm going to start using Windows 2150. Because you can just make up bullshit in the future. Nobody will know. I mean, you know, people don't know what year it is. They're fine.
I'm sorry. You've been in way too many business meetings for me that you know enough people who don't know what year it is.
Oh, my God. Oh, geez. Yeah, I'm still working on the article 15 time zone mistakes programmers will make when dealing with interplanetary time. You tweeted earlier today that they're working on time zones for Mars. I'm like, oh, that's great. That's a blog essay right there. Somebody needs to write the coding errors you make in interplanetary applications.
What could possibly go wrong with time zones on different planets?
Yeah, that's a kind of a weird problem because, you know, we've got Greenwich Mean Time here for the world that's a round world, right? But if you deal with multiple spheres, you can't even say with reliability whether it's day or night or the offset keeps changing. It's cray-cray, man.
Well, the one that I really worry about is much more so the date problem.
Yeah.
Do you realize how weird it's going to be 10,000 years when humans live on 485 different planets?
Okay, so
we all still measure dates based on Earth.
Yeah, see, well, that's the question now. So do we do this? Say maybe you just keep the day like 24 hours, right? And so, or in which case, every day would be a different length, right? Or you could just say a day
because you immediately run into a problem with that. Because if a day is 24 hours,
right,
how would that work on Mars?
So I guess that's what I'm saying. So on Mars, 25-hour day. You just say, bullshit, that's going to be 24 hours. Because it's a day is when the thing, whatever you're on goes around is 24 hours. So that would kind of work, right? Because it would be like every Martian hour would be like, you know, 56 minutes of U.S. hours or something. But then it would fall completely apart with like the moon, which has a 28-day. Like, if you go to the moon for an hour-long meeting, buddy, you better bring some food because it's going to be a while up there, you know, geez. It's like, man, this thing's gone on for a whole hour. Shit. Yeah, I don't know. If you did the sort of interpolation sort of relative motion thing, you would know whether it's day or night, and it would kind of make sense. But if you do the flat time, then good luck. I mean, good luck scheduling like a Zoom call between Mercury, the Moon, and like U.S. or whatever. It's just.
Well, and we think time zones are bad.
Yeah. But at the speed of light thing is going to be kind of tough, too, with, like, you know, Mercury, whatever, the 40-second delay. Gee, think lag's bad now. Whoa. Yeah. Of course, what you could probably do at that point, if your lag was, like, under a minute, the AI could figure out what you were going to bullshit about next and just, like, pre-bullshit for you.
Well, to be fair, there's probably many listeners here who are using Comcast, so they're already used to this.
Yes, for those of you on Comcast, Happy New Year. It's now 2022, and we're having a great time. Yeah, I think, but see, the important thing is the AI can just kind of, like, pre-guess what you're going to be bullshitting about and just transmit that meaning to the people, like, on other planets. And as long as they continue reacting, hey, who cares whether you're actually the person talking or the AI was making up your image to appear as if you were talking? Like, whoa, wow. I had a whole meeting and didn't even meet the guy. So with this next article is we're sending these Javelin anti-tank missiles to Ukraine, and there is no, like, quick start card inside the box. There's no, like, we're tech support line. They just got these little boxes with these random, you know, $200,000 explosive missiles. And of course, we know how to use them, but if there's any problem, there's just no support at all. It's almost like we've given them guns without bullets. They're like, hey, dudes, where the hell's this stuff that's supposed to come with these missiles?
So they're supposed to just be, you point them at something and shoot.
Yeah. Well, yeah, worst job in the world. Like a tech support guy who gets hired to like support Javelin missile users in Ukraine.
Well, to be fair, they were made for military, so they were made for the lowest common denominator.
They should, yeah. Well, yeah. But hello, this is Joe. Can I help you? I'm trying to get the missile fire. There's tanks everywhere. Thank you for calling. Your call is very valued to us. If you, I'm dying. Press 2 if you're dying right away. Press 3 if you're under missile fire. the Javelin story, especially when you talk about systems and systems that learn, it's like these are relatively cheap, supposedly, like you said, lowest common denominator. They kill tanks. They're wonderful. People loving these damn things. And first of all, we can't build them fast enough, even though they're easy to build. And second of all, we're giving them to Ukraine without any core support material that we keep ourselves. So it's like, it'd be like somebody asking for the internet and like shipping them a modem. Most of us could figure it out, but not everybody. Some people would be like, what the hell is this?
No. I think it'd be more like shipping them a cable modem, but they don't have wires.
So they don't have a cable. Yes. Yes, plug the cable up to the modem. What cable? The cable. I don't see a cable. Well, you're going to have to contact your apartment vendor for that. Okay, so I really like this next tool. I like this tool, and I hate this tool. Okay, this tool is Mark Gwynn. So if you haven't been following along with Markdown, Markdown is the easy-to-use thing that you can put rich data in, like HTML or whatever. And now that it's been so easy to use and everybody uses it, we're overloading the crap out of this thing to make it do all sorts of other shit it never did. And this is the latest version. You can put in easy text files and create these cool little time charts and such.
So for me, the creating of the time charts is not really the cool part. Mm-hmm. And it is pretty cool.
Yeah.
So I think I've mentioned before, I'm a really big fan of Markdown.
Hmm. I don't know if you have or not.
The benefit I see is not just the ability to add things in the future, but that's an easily parsable format which represents my past.
I've become much more of a fan than I was at first. The universal simple format's cool. Ability to check in and out files and do changes, like text-based changes, way cool.
Well, yeah, and that if I've been keeping, let's say, like my last 3 years in this format,
yes,
I can reasonably easily parse it. I mean,
yes,
hell, right now, trying to go back and figure out what I've done for the last 3 years based on like my calendars, oh dear, this would be days of work.
I think that the beauty of Markdown is that the stuff we actually deal with every day is just a small amount of just plain text, and the computer should do the rest of the work, and instead we somehow ended up in some system where we've got all of this extraneous bullshit around that small amount of data, so let's just pull that crap out. And Markdown makes a lot of sense to me. At first it didn't, but I'm like, yeah, okay, I get it now. It's good stuff. My only problem with Markdown is that it was so easy and such a cool standard that now we're overloading it. So it's like, okay, you're talking about common Markdown? You're talking about Markdown with extensions? Which extensions are you talking about? Checkbox extensions?
LeanPub Markdown?
Yeah, it's like LeanPub Markdown. Is it GitHub flavored Markdown? It's like, fuck! It's not a standard anymore. Everybody's got a different version of it.
This has been pretty much every standard that we've ever made.
Oh, hadn't it been? You know, and I'm doing this book in Markdown, and I'm doing the Markdown in Obsidian. I love it. Beautiful tool. LeanPub takes Markdown. We talked about the problems here. So I've got a workflow that works for everything except for footnotes. Why not footnotes? You know, I have no fucking idea. It works in Obsidian, works in LeanPub. It's the same fucking format both places. It doesn't work. It's like, it's not a simple text format if I'm having to debug it. It's no longer Ixnay on the format A, yeah. Hey, this is something I know that you like cooking quite a bit. I do as well. This is robots learning to stir fry shit. That's pretty awesome. I'm thinking we're not going to be that far off from, I mean, having a kitchen robot. It can stir fry. It can put things away already. Amazon's been spending like hundreds of millions of dollars on robots to just get shit in and off of shelves. This is stir frying. It's a kitchen centered robot does not sound that far-fetched to me.
Well, this would be the first step towards solving world hunger.
Yeah, feed them rascals.
If everybody had a stir-fry robot.
Yes. Yes, especially if we can make it out of edible parts. That way, either it feeds you or you eat it.
What I'm really waiting for, though, is the Himalayan grill machine.
Ooh, what do Himalayans take like when you grill them? Are they tasty, or you have to... You need a big wok for that, right? What? Is there such a thing as Himalayan grills?
There is. They're actually like 5 feet across.
Good God, man. Do
they
put a whole yak in there?
They put all kinds of things on top of them. Basically, it's like a stir fry. Just the sauces are a bit different. Uh-huh. And then they slide it off into like the thing that you're going to eat.
I've been to a lot of Mongolian barbecues, and I haven't found one yet that's got a good Mongolian in it. It's all like a bunch of American dudes back there, and they don't even serve Mongolians. There's no Mongolian cooking. You can't get it one cooked. There's no none. Why do they even call it Mongolian barbecue? And it looks just like regular like food. I don't know what is the. Do you know what the definition of a Mongolian barbecue is, Greg?
I think it's just that it comes off of like that 5 foot wide frame.
I tell you, I love music and I love food and I love them for the same reason in that if you look at the history of music or food, it's people taking random shit from different places and just like, hey, what happens if you put this in here? Oh yeah, that's kind of cool. And it's just, we create these new things just by randomly putting things together. Okay. So this is the one we've been waiting for. This is the question I have asked myself many, many a time. Why don't we have more bananas in computer programming?
Oh, because it's bananas.
It is bananas. You're correct. You're correct. Did you know that there's only one banana? All bananas you eat today are clones of one another. There's only one master universal banana we all eat from.
What made me kind of connect with this story is that I feel like it could be one that I could have written. There was a bit inside of it. I immediately went to tell my roommate, who is also an electrical engineer. He looked me in the face and burst out laughing.
Yes, yes.
At that moment, I realized I had a great project in my hands.
I love these stories where it's like, this seemed like something fun to do.
Well, this is precisely like how I tend to end up in projects. Like, I might be telling you, dude, I've been thinking about doing this thing with programming languages where I'm going to make everything so that it comes out as a finite state machine. And you would tell me, what?
What? Yeah, fun stuff.
I knew I had a great project on my hands at that moment.
Yeah, I love, we've rented several of these. I bet you it's at least been two or three a month where the guy's just like, hey, I thought I would try this. It looked like fun. What was it last week? It was a floppy disk music machine. I don't know if we got to that. Did you see that video? Wow. That guy it was like he made an orchestra out of floppy disks. Hmm.
One thing that struck me a little bit odd about this one was that we already have true random number generators.
With bananas?
Not with bananas, but we have numerous other true random number generators.
Well, this would be with other fruit, like kumquats or potatoes or something?
Well, the main problem that I see with this particular one is what would happen if we were to have a slot machine and we had to install a banana inside of each one?
Besides, of course, the monkey problem, there'd probably be some fruit rotting, fruit
flies. I mean, there would be hundreds of monkeys all around.
Yeah, that might be why we don't have the banana-based slot machines that we've always wanted, is the monkey and the fruit. So there's a lot of random number generators, but you're telling me there's not really a lot of fruit-powered random number generators.
The animal probably do the watermelon as well.
Are you sure this is a random number? Here, eat that, dude. I guess they're doing the radioactive decay of bananas, right? Because bananas are quite radioactive, relatively speaking.
Well, how else would you explain King Kong?
I have yet to find a good explanation for King Kong, but the banana thing may be it. Yeah. you know, Godzilla was created due to a lot of radiation. And I think he ate bananas as well. I never saw him eat, but I'm sure he ate something. Not people. But I see Greg typing right now. What did Godzilla eat? Little Godzilla.
That's actually precisely what I typed. He eats everything from trucks to prickly trees.
Well, there you go. See, that's how you end up going from a little Godzilla to a big one. You just eat a truck.
Well, but what I was going to say is maybe we should start considering putting the calories onto trucks when you go to buy them. Like, you should have the same stamp.
Yeah. Yes. This truck serves two Godzillas. We'd like to order the tractor trailer. Is that a four Godzilla or three?
180,000 calories.
Oh my God. But the fiber count, I mean, this is some good roughage in a good sized pickup truck. You're not going to have any flow problems after that. Oh my God. So I love this project. One of the things I have regretted is not building more cool, like Raspberry Pi projects or this thing with the bananas. Like, these are fun things we could be doing that I wish I had more time to do. Yeah. Oh, he's got a board. It's even labeled Banana Random Number Generator. I'm waiting for the article, like, you know, Banana Random Number Generator cracked by hackers from, you know, Tibet. That can show that they can buy an identical banana and predict the numbers. Yeah, cool story. An 8-bit parallel version with smaller tubes ought to be doable. Oh, wow. So we've already been working toward the number of bits per banana problem that we probably scientists have struggled with that for years. Wow, very cool. The operation to banana random generator isn't limited by that, only by the lifetime of the banana. Now, so see, this is the problem. See, even though the radioactive thing has a half-life of 1.25 billion years, most bananas do not last past a billion years.
I think we need to do an empirical study on this.
Yeah, you could like put a banana in lucite, right? Or some sort of amber, maybe. And you could keep a banana for a while. Keep that banana, good banana radioactivity just to come. Yeah, see, one of the things about these articles is if they're fun enough, all of these other technical people just sort of dive in and produce all this other, like, extraneous technical bullshit you'd never really cared to know, but it's like, oh, wow, you know, one billion years for radioactive bananas. Who knew? Wow, the decay of radioactive potassium in the banana may not be enough to significantly raise the signal rate above the background noise with a given detector. See? So maybe, wow, so this whole thing, Greg, fake news, man. Oh, man. The chai value being wrong. Ah, jeez, well, this is, I really feel ripped off. You know, I was going to buy the radioactive banana random number generator kit. I had had a hat coming, and now it's all a bunch of bullshit. So, Greg, I have to ask you. You weren't here at the beginning, but I got to know, dude. Passport. No passport. Motherfucker.
As far as I know, it's now in Philadelphia.
Well, that is a sad state of affairs.
They keep promising me that they'll have it within the next 3 days.
Wow.
I actually kind of believe them this time, because they've at least moved it out of the office in Florida, and they've moved it to Philadelphia.
They wouldn't lie about that. Like the old airplane joke up, you know, when's the plane going to land? I can't tell you. You can tell me I'm the pilot in a half hour. But you can tell me in a half hour? No, we're going to land in a half hour. Yeah, I don't know. It's a. I was telling Melissa about your travails, and that's like really, really messed up, my friend. Really messed up.
If nothing else, at least the people that I finally managed to get through to at FedEx have kind of recognized that, yeah, we're not slightly screwed up at this point. We are really, really screwed up at this point.
Yeah, you're definitely out there. Tell you what, look, I'm gonna
I'd have to pull up the precise dates, but I believe we're now over a month that it's been in their possession.
Oh, wow. Tell you, I'm going to try something new here. I'm going to pause the recording and hit the restroom and be right back here. See if we can see this happen here. Okay, well, we're back, and it's been a quick break. Okay, so we were talking about bananas, and this is sort of a quick week on a roundup, so I thought I'd just sort of stop here. We can sort of shoot the shit a little bit. So I talked about guests. You have any idea about guests?
As in, who's a good guest to bring on?
Well, I mean, should we do guests? Because, you know, it's me, you, James, John. It's about four of us, off and on. And I had 10 people on the list. I think a lot of folks would want to come, but they'd rather like come once or twice on a schedule than just sort of feel like it's open. It's like for some people, having an open
What I think we should do is actually bring them in, put them up on a crucifix, and then demand them to answer questions.
See, that's a good idea. That's the kind of idea that's outside the box.
You can imagine bringing in Eric Evans. And then he's up on the crucifix and tell us about DDD right now. An aggregate boundary should be what?
Oh, boy. Don't get into boundaries. Well, I'd rather do tabs or spaces or, yeah. You don't want to depend. I don't think the tech community is ready to do boundaries yet. I just don't think they're not there.
What could be more fun would be to actually bring on two people at a time who disagree with each other.
We've talked about this, and it is a fine art. I have enjoyed doing stuff like that, and I've had people say, look, I've enjoyed watching you disagree with somebody else over something, but that's a fine art to be able to do that. And you run into people who become very good at talking and not very good at listening, so... I mean, I want to have conversations where I learn shit, not where I watch people. I can watch people argue like in my backyard. Are you there?
Yeah, but if you can get the right people, it could be very interesting.
It could be interesting. I don't know. I don't know. You know, I read an article, I think I posted on the Discord, that the Garnet newspaper chain has stopped taking opinion pieces from local people that don't have local issues. And the problem they run into is people were like defaulting back to these national bullshit issues that everybody wants to argue about, and there's just no quality there. So, yeah, it would be cool if people could argue about a technical thing in a way I haven't heard before. That takes some discipline. I'm not sure everybody has that kind of discipline.
But what would happen if, for instance, we were to bring on Matt's and Don Syme, and we're to talk about typing?
Don Syme's a good example. I don't know, Don, you know him, but he's the kind of guy I would like to, like, ask questions about C#, because I've heard him say things on Twitter that made me think that maybe he feels the community's a little astray. Hell, I'd like to ask Don about some questions about the F# community, because I got my own problems with those guys, but it's like, how do you have that conversation, like, when you're just... putting somebody up as a talking head. I love the idea.
Oh, no,
but
if we were to have him talking with Matt's about typing and whether typing is valuable or invaluable.
I don't know.
That could be a very interesting conversation.
So let me propose that my idea was that we find some people, it doesn't matter who they are, maybe the initial five people that don't come, and we say, hey, can you come on this particular date? And we leave it open to the rest of us, like you and me and John and Jenks. If we can come by, that's fine. If not, that's fine. But we make a fixed date for these folks. And then we just experiment with talking with them to see if we can, like, then figure out where we want to go from there. Instead of, I think it may be too big of a jump to say, yeah, let's put them in a jar, shake them, make them fight. I was like, okay, yeah, it might work with, like, stink bugs. I'm not sure it's going to work with, like, professionals.
You might be surprised. There are some with very strong opinions on both sides, and if you just put them into a room and shake the jar.
Okay, so we know quite a few professional folks, and I know two professional folks that I approached to do Nerd Roundup a year or two ago, and they were like, hey, I would love to do that as long as the right people are there. And I asked those people, who are the right people? And they wouldn't tell me. And it struck me, and I think maybe Bob may be one of the wrong people, I'm not sure, but it struck me if I had the wrong person on, that it just would be beneath them to appear at that time.
It's dude, like, come on. You've been working on software projects for decades. You should be used to this by now.
I have become convinced that there's a lot of fucking thought leaders in the IT industry that I would never want to work with that are probably useless. And the reason why is they seem to be unable to have the self-assurance to state an opinion and defend it and then like back down if they're wrong or just sort of deal with reality. Instead, they're very closed-minded about being vulnerable to the wrong ideas and all this stuff. And that's, in my mind, that's just not a professional I want to work with.
I've dealt with many of those people.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
But there are a substantial number of people who, where even when you talk to them and you say, you know, this isn't necessarily right or wrong. It belongs in a context.
Yes.
So let's discuss the context that it belongs in.
Yes. Yeah, I found that moving to the meta layer, and I don't mean this like it's a bullshit thing, but moving to the meta layers tends to work around a lot of these conflicts, and it's beautiful that it does. But the thing is that if you're not even going to appear on some random dude's blog who's got like two readers because it's the wrong person there, there's something else going on with your career and your professional standards that really, I can't help you with.
But to be fair, I can actually make a reasonable argument why all of your code should be in the main method.
I would not disagree with you.
There is literally a reasonable argument to make that everything should be done this way. We should put all of our code in the main method every time. Because otherwise, you're going to have to like remember the names of functions and things.
Greg, it sounds like a crazy thing, but I'm actually agreeing with you. See, I'm doing this functional smells book, which I have to talk about because I'm spending all my time on it. But one of the reasons it's needed, and it's not just a coding smells, is that once you start thinking functionally, it changes the way you think about problems. And good functional code means I don't have to think about that bullshit. I think you saw the graphic I did earlier. You're trying to reduce the amount of cognitive load on the programmer. And yeah, if you're good at that, it could all go in a main method. Why the hell wouldn't it go in a main method?
Well, and this is also something that is hard for developers to learn.
Yeah.
Because they have been taught from their very first class in university that this 300 line of code thing needs to have at least 67 different functions.
Yes.
It needs to have...
Yeah.
And when you show them that, well, it's 300 lines of code. If I just wrote it top down, like, what is the maintainability difference here?
I said this different at another time, but one of the most critically important things for me to do as a professional, I did about 15 years ago. I decided to write, you know, I was going to write, I don't forget, it was a book recommendation page. I think I was going to call it hn-books.com. And I was like, hey, how do I create an online system to, like, put in book recommendations and tell people? And to do that, I decided what I was going to do was to try to do the minimal amount of stuff necessary. I thought it would just be some kind of a lark, you know, do I need a server, do I need a what, blah, blah, blah. And so I started pulling shit out just to see what I needed to do this book recommendation system. I ended up with almost nothing. And what I learned there was, oh my God, the delta between what code I actually need to solve most problems in the world and the code I'm actually applying to most problems is freaking huge. And Greg has frozen.
I'm still here.
Okay.
I can hear you.
Ah, good deal. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, it was so eye-opening that my, like, baseline of what I thought was complex. And the reason I brought that up was you were saying that we teach people they need to have 400-line pieces of code with 60 methods. I don't think we explicitly do that. Nobody ever told me, oh, you got to have a bunch of code. It's just that it's sort of baked into the way people code. It's like, of course, you've got an important project. It has to have a bunch of source files. No, the problem and the solution are not related in programming. They should not be.
Well, there's the other side of this, which is that we deal with non-technical people.
Yes.
Can you imagine if you gave me a complex business problem and you were going to pay me $100,000 to solve it, and I came back to you with 230 lines of code that actually solved that problem?
Right.
It was in one file, which I copy and pasted into the email, and here's the solution to your problem.
It makes me very angry because what I'm seeing, and I know it's not on purpose, but I'm seeing people do these presentations in this really popular rah-rah shit where you do this magic trick with this new thing you made. Here's a magic trick, blah, 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 it's easy. And people all get excited, and then they charge a gazillion dollars follow-on consulting services to actually show to people how to do the damn job. And so it's like you sell them on some kind of stupid magic trick stuff that this new thingamajob will do the thing you want it to. And then you end up consulting, actually doing the work that the programmer, not the business owner, but the programmer you've convinced doesn't actually need to do it.
Whoa. Let's stop talking about BizTalk.
The funny thing is, I don't know if you need BizTalk or BizTalk, because either way it works. The joke works either way. Yeah, I think the functional programming smells book is needed because functional code does not work the way other code works, and it's so different that once you start thinking about, hey, when I type in this token, do I get the same thing back every time? And the answer is yes. Then the logical follow-on is, why do I have to worry about anything that happens after typing in that token? And the answer is no, you don't have to. That's a completely different programming environment than anybody else really codes in. It's a strange thing. And even stranger is...
You mostly have me wondering right now if I can go find a sea REPL.
Ooh.
A sea REPL would be so much fun to play with.
Oh, my God. Wow. I guess that would work. Interesting. I don't know how you would work with... statics.
If I underflow in a C REPL, does that change the REPL itself?
No. If you cat a null file, does that change cat? No. If you...
Yeah, but that's not how C works.
It's not how C works. Because the thing is that with procedural imperative programming, each little step, you have to think, well, what happens if the step doesn't work? And many times you just don't know, and we stop caring pretty quickly.
Well, but you also have the thing in C or Pascal, or quite a few other languages, where you have, as an example, underwritten your stack. So now you get jumped into random points in code.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This would be really, really cool to implement in a REPL. Yeah,
that's true.
So it's like you are on step number 18 in your REPL. You write some C code inside of your REPL, and it jumps you back to step number 2 in your REPL.
Not something that happens a lot anywhere else. But yeah, I'm trying to find that graphic, I suppose, in your way.
But the absolute pain this could cause to developers would be brilliant.
Yeah, I think the gimmick is not that there's pain. The gimmick is that it looks really, really happy and cool and what everybody else is going to be doing, but then the pain comes later, and you're ashamed to admit that there's pain, so you'll pay other people to come in and make the pain go away. That's the whole business is founded on that thing.
Well, I'm just thinking about students coming into this, and like they're working in it, and so they're implementing their first linked list, and they're going through the C REPL. And then the next thing you know, you're debugging Windows.
Fun times. There we go. Okay, so here's the graphic I was talking about just for folks that did not on the Discord. This is from the book. It's like, what's a variable and what's a function in this code? And I took a snapshot out of some code, and the code says, let winning lottery numbers equal foo, bar, baz, boop, bop, beep. Which is, of course, nonsense. And my challenge to the reader was, circle the functions in red. And the problem to this challenge is, it's a gimmick question. It doesn't matter, you don't care. And that's a different scenario, because The thing is that an imperative in O code, we say it doesn't matter, but it does matter because there's all kinds of little things going on in there and you don't know what it is. And it turns out it matters quite a bit, whereas in pure functional code, it really, really doesn't matter.
Well, whether you return me a value or whether it is a value,
yes,
is essentially the same thing.
It is the same thing, and it can be the same thing. And by making it the same thing, actually, it makes the code less complex, not more complex. And that's what drives me crazy is people think of things like Haskell and F-sharp and things like OCaml as being more complex code. But if done well, it can be easier. I think the problem, and this goes off on the F-sharp community and the Haskell community, is the problem is we take this beautiful idea and we go immediately to things like type classes and RDTs we talked about. We take this beautiful idea and we make it even more complicated, doing the same bullshit that was done to the O people just to the functional folks. I've read Don Syme several times talk about functors, for one thing.
Wait. How did you read Don Syme talk?
I have a speech-to-text program I use. It's a... Well, it beats hearing him type, because when you hear him type, it's just click, click, click. But he's talked about...
You can actually work out, based on the click, 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 which keys it actually is.
which is how I learned to type itself. I listened to a lot of people type. You're gonna start this bullshit. We're gonna go down to bullshit, okay? Anyway, I've heard Syme say many times, and he's tried to say it nicely, but we are our own worst enemies, even in the functional code land, because we so love this idea of being able to do higher order functions and all this type class stuff and really cool things with functions. We end up making the same damn mess the OO imperative guys have made. It's just even more damn complicated and hard to understand than the OO guys. So
a reasonable statement.
Yeah, I think I wanted to say it because there's no magic, kind of sauce, or there's no panacea as far as pure functional code, but there is a thing that says if I have a pure function that returns an integer, for instance, with no side effects, I can treat that just like an integer because I don't care. It's just an integer to me. It doesn't matter whether it's a function or a value.
Well, and if it's pure, then it doesn't matter when I call it.
There you go, which gets you lazy evaluation. But that is a radically different thing the way to understand your programming, because I've always been taught, since I was first started, was, you have this thing, and you go to find this thing, and you go somewhere, and it does other things, and that's true, but you don't care anymore. Pure functions, it's like, okay, I got this thing, I don't care what's a function, 10,000 lines of functions, and maybe it goes to Mars. It's an int. Okay, let's use it like an int.
If it walks like a duck, talks like a duck.
Probably, yeah. Probably not a duck. So I had to...
It's actually a velociraptor.
Well, we saw... Oh, wow. We saw the latest Jurassic Park movie. Have you seen that yet?
I don't believe so.
I'm trying to say this in a nice way. Do you like pictures of dinosaurs eating people?
Obviously, it is one of my highest goals in life to find pictures of dinosaurs eating people.
Well, there you go. Then you will love this movie. If you want to go to a movie in which you're presented with 30 or 40 little vignettes that you're supposed to talk about later, of which only one or two actually you remember, it makes a difference, this is the movie for you, with dinosaurs.
But they can't possibly have done better than, I'm trying to remember which Jurassic Park it was, where they knocked over the little porta potty, and the guy was sitting on the toilet and then was eaten.
That was the first one. The first one was good. It was based on a Michael Crichton book. Crichton could write some hellacious good sci-fi. It just, I tell Melissa, at some point they realized people were rooting for the dinosaurs, and so the movie became like sci-fi about unintended consequences, and it became something more like, let's build dinosaurs and make them fight, and they're the really cool guys.
But having one of the main characters literally be eaten off of the toilet.
Yes.
Was just genius.
It was beautiful. That was a lot of really iconic. And the music, the John Horner, gosh, a lot of really good stuff about that first. I told Melissa that they should have called this last one Jurassic Park Season of the Witch. Does anybody get this joke? I'm just going to keep using this joke and I get a laugh sooner or later. You remember Halloween? Eventually Halloween had a Halloween 5 Season of the Witch. Yeah, okay. All right, people are going to be laughing later.
And I nodded my head, but I realized that your video is frozen, so you couldn't see me nod my head.
Yeah, then there's a Highlander 2, which will also go down the annals of, oh my God, why did you do that?
Oh, come on. Aren't they right now on, like, Highlander, like, 173?
It doesn't matter. They, you know, it used to be that you'd have a Highlander, you'd have a second Highlander, or Planet of the Apes. You'd screw the pooch. People would get upset. They would yell, and then you'd do a bunch of straight to video stuff. They've realized it doesn't matter. Just keep pumping this shit out. People keep buying it. They just want to go home and tell their kids stories about seeing a new dinosaur movie. What else have we been watching? Some cool stuff. I started on this Web of Lies on Netflix today, which is about internet crime. True crime stuff, hackers making money. It was, I'll give it like a 40 out of 100. It was all right.
Oh, but we're going to go back to an old one now. Hmm? Have you ever seen the Hackers movie?
Let's see. Was that the whopper with the world... I want to play a game. Was that Hackers?
Hackers was a movie. And let me just pull it up just to
Johnny
make sure that I have it right.
There have been
this,
so
this
many.
This goes back to like 1995.
There's so many bad hacking movies.
No. This one is particularly bad.
Oh my God.
And it's worth watching.
Okay, well, hey, sign me up for that then.
So let's see. Yeah, so it starts with this one hacker who's an 11-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
Is fined $45,000 for crashing 1,500 computers, and he caused a 7-point drop in the New York Stock Exchange.
Yeah.
Now, what's hilarious about this is today a 7-point drop would be like.
Oh my God.
Well, that happened at 3 o'clock.
Yeah, much more volatile. Yeah. What's the old joke is that you see a hacker in a movie, and it's, hey, can you break into blah, blah, blah? And they sit down and go, and like, okay, I got in. Like, what the hell is that? How did you do that?
So, you'll get a laugh out of the name of the other hacker. Okay. Acid Burn.
Acid Burn. Oh, my God.
And then it later became Crash Override.
Okay. So I'm watching this thing about true crime, internet hackers, cool stuff on Netflix. This is Netflix out this year. And the first one's like a, you know, fake identity thing, good story. You know, internet enables people to assume other identities. Second, it was a six episode thing. The second episode was basically... people who like Donald Trump say things that are not true. But, okay, they do. And then the third was kind of the same. And then the fourth and fifth are really, really cool stories about people who hacked the entire system and made millions of dollars. But my point being is that here we are in 2022, and we can't even tell what a good hacking story is or not. We're 30 years into hacking, and we still don't even know what the hell to call it.
Well, but most of the best hacking stories... You learn about 10 years later.
That's true. That is true.
So you find out all kinds of hacking stories of, oh, we DDoS this site. And it's like, well, yeah, it's not really fucking complicated.
No.
I can do that. Would you like me to do it to your site on Tuesday?
Yeah, a mutual friend of ours, I was talking to him online the other day, I was telling him that for the really, really cool stuff I know would like to talk about, I don't talk about it because it seems like it just adds to the problem in general. It doesn't seem to help anything.
Well, but when you start saying things like, yeah, I've got a slight hack I know here that will allow you to super user on a random FreeBSD box. This is worth a lot of money.
Yeah, it is. I think a lot of these stories, even the bullshit I hate Trump stories, which I didn't like Trump myself, but a lot of these stories boil down to, hey, there's a bunch of money into making this small a bit of moral compromise. So the guy does that. A bunch of money making this extra next little small bit of moral compromise. And so somebody else does that. And so very quickly, you know, you end up with somebody totally lying to you because there's a lot of money in that. So that's why I have a problem talking about hacking things in general because, dang, who knows who you might be helping out?
I'm just quite worried that you would think a politician would ever lie to you.
That is the thing. Or, even more so, that you could tell for sure and for absolute, you know, for all eternity, whether a politician's telling you the truth or not. That's even more, much a more weird concept than actually whether they're lying, because I know they're lying, but to think that a politician's telling me the truth, hell, I can't tell the truth whether or not, like, I've gained 3 pounds last week. Why do you expect this guy to tell me anything about nuclear missile defense? Crazy.
Nuclear missile defense. They even lie about things like whether or not the town homeless shelter was open yesterday at 9 o'clock at night.
I know. And my point being, sometimes it's a purposeful lie. Sometimes they're just sort of like playing with words, as politicians are known to do. Sometimes they don't know any better. But yet, as a consumer of this information, we're expected to somehow categorize all of this into lie or not. It's total bullshit. And as you understand, you agree with me, I'm sure.
Yes, but what I'm more surprised at is when we actually run into a situation where it's found the politician was telling the truth. These are the interesting ones.
Yeah, I think I was reading a biography of Winston Churchill a couple months ago, and the guy was making the point that Churchill always did what he thought was right. He followed that by saying, you know, many times it turned out to be mistaken, and he picked people that did wrong things, but Churchill was convinced that whatever he thought was right, he was going to do, and he was going to explain why he did it. And like, well, yeah, that's probably the best we can expect for, you know, it's tell me why you think this is right. Do the thing you think is right. Adapt when you learn differently. That's much better than expecting a politician to be like Moses or something.
Well, there's the alternative that we can look at having politicians kind of similar to death games. So if you get elected to be a politician, you have 4 years.
Yes. I agree with this. This is a good idea.
If you make it out of that 4 years without anything associated to you, you survive.
It's also a good idea.
And you become on the committee to make more petitions, more politicians.
I think that we should put time limits on most laws, number one, because it's easy to make a law that somehow benefits you or your friends. And the second thing is that we've got 200 million people. Everybody gets a shot at doing whatever you want to do as far as representative government. You want to be a president or whatever, but there's a time limit to that as well because we got 200 million people.
Oh, dear. Time limits on laws. Do you have any idea how many laws there are?
It would be very difficult to retrofit, yes. All right, so I am going to wind this up. Greg, anything you've watched, read, consumed you'd like to talk about before we leave?
Nothing in particular.
Okie dokie. Hang on 1 second. Let me do my goodbye thing. Hang on. Well, there you go. You've lost yet another hour of Nerd Roundup. Thank you for dropping by. I'm Daniel Markham. I'm on danielbmarkham.com. I will see you on the internet.